Okay, with a brand new book, the third book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, please remember that whatever number it says on the spine of your book, completely disregard, it is the third book. We go by the order in which he wrote them, because when you go in the internal chronological order, some of the later books are prequels, and it's just not as good. When you want a good prequel, harkens back to the older story and fills in some gaps that you didn't even know were there. But when you read the prequel first, it kind of takes a little of the drama out of the original, because when you get there, you've already had some questions answered that you didn't know you were supposed to ask yet. So anyway, we are on the third book, and it is a good jumping off place, but we will take a quick recap. So this is happening, this is all occurring within the 1940s. And there is a family in England. The first book is occurring during World War II. It's occurring at some point along the time of the London Blitz. And the children are evacuated into the country. They're very young. You know, Peter's the oldest of the four, and he's probably about 12, is my guess, 12, 13. Lucy's the youngest, she's probably about 6. And they're in the countryside at this old, amazing house of an old cantankerous professor. They encounter a magic wardrobe and are transported into this other realm. It's like it's its own universe. They're in the country of Narnia, where it is always winter and never Christmas. It is under the thrall and control of the evil White Witch. And the children have these amazing adventures where we deal with bravery and treachery. We deal with hope, and we deal with sorrow. And they meet for the first time the true hero of the story, though the kids, they fight and they work. But the central hero of the story, and the only way the White Witch is truly defeated, is through the work of whom?
Aslan,
the great lion. Aslan is the Christ character of this Narnian universe, referred to as the son of the emperor over the sea. He gives his life as the innocent in order to redeem Edmund, the traitor. Edmund's life is spared. On the stone table, Aslan is killed by the White Witch. She is very knowledgeable that the magic that binds Narnia together says that she has the ability to murder traitors. But what she did not know is that woven into the fabric of Narnia even before its creation is a deeper magic still, that when one without sin is willing to die for the one who did sin, that death itself would work backwards. We have a resurrection story within that first book, and a final defeat of the witch and an end of winter. The four Pevensey children are proclaimed kings and queens of Narnia forever, and Narnia just kind of goes along its merry way as they grow up as kings and queens, and then eventually stumble back through the wardrobe to find out that no time whatsoever had passed. In Narnian time, they were in their 20s or 30s, but they go right back to the instant that they left when they were returned to England. The second book happens about a year later in English time. Ostensibly, the war is over at that point, or at least it's moved into a theater where they're not in immediate danger. And it's really more of a continental European issue because they're getting ready to go back to school. Right as they're about ready to go back to school, they're going to be separated, going off to different schools for the first time. They are yanked away to Narnia, but this is a Narnia they don't recognize. As it turns out, an indeterminate amount of time has passed. Hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years have passed, and Narnia lies in ruins. They can't find any hide nor hair of the way things used to be, other than old ancient ruins. And as it turns out, 10 generations prior, a neighboring country invaded Narnia, took it over, a neighboring country of men, the Telmarines from the land of Telmar. They drove the talking animals and the mythological creatures deep underground and tried to wipe out all memory of them. But the 10th of the line of kings, Caspian, had been taught in secret about the real history of Narnia, and his heart loved it, and his heart yearned for Aslan to be real. His uncle, who was a pretender to the throne, decided to have him killed, and Caspian flees, only to find these old Narnians in hiding. With the help of the Pevensey children, who have actually been called back to Narnia through Susan's own magic horn, they seek to help Caspian regain his throne. There is a pitched battle, but once again, who is the savior of Narnia? It's Aslan. And through Aslan's work, Myraz is killed, the Telmarine army is destroyed, and old Narnia is redeemed and made new. Caspian is proclaimed true king and anointed by Aslan himself, because, you know, Narnia is only right when a son of Adam or a daughter of Eve is in charge, and it is to be kind of a new golden age. Just as there was a first golden age of Narnia with the Pevensey children, well, now Caspian, even though he's young, he's a teenager too, he's probably about Peter's age, give or take, the Pevensey children are brought back to England at kind of the completion of this quest and of this story. Aslan has spent some personal time with Peter and Susan prior to them returning, where they admit to the younger children that only the younger ones will return to Narnia. So the story's about to begin anew. And that's where we are. A little more time has passed. Another year or two has passed. It seems that the war is now done. And why would I say that? What makes it sound, within the context of this first chapter, that World War II is actually over?
They go back home. And the parents are traveling to America.
Yeah. Parents are traveling to America.
Yeah.
Right. So the father is a lecturer of some sort.
Yeah.
And so he is given the opportunity to go lecture abroad at some American university or maybe multiple universities. And so that's not really something you typically do in wartime, not in active warfare.
No.
So presumably this is done, and so, but this is still kind of a big deal. We're still talking about the 40s. You're not jet-setting back and forth.
No.
So this is probably setting sail, I guess, and they're going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
And so the parents are leaving for America so the father can lecture. Let's take account of the four children. Where's Peter?
He's in school.
Okay, he's studying probably to get into college. That would be my assumption based on age. These are his pre-university exams.
Yeah.
And so he's off with the professor.
Yeah, and he's lost all his money.
He's not in that great big house anymore.
No, so he couldn't take the other.
Right, so there's no room for all the other kids. Where's Susan?
She's going to America.
Because she doesn't do well in school.
She's not really of a scholastic type.
She's not too smart, but she's beautiful, so maybe she'll do that with the husband.
No, she's not. That's pretty good, but she's not too smart, but she's beautiful. And so they seem to think that America will do her good.
Yeah.
Or at least
she'll learn more there than
around here, because school's not her thing.
Yeah, right.
So that leaves the two younger children, Edmund and Lucy, who I would assume, you know, my guess is Edmund's probably about 14 by now. He's somewhere between 12 and 14. Lucy's probably around 10.
Yeah.
Where are they?
They get sent to England.
They get sent to some.
Alberta.
Yes, they get sent to relations to stay for the summer. It's too expensive to take them to America. There's no room to stay with the professor and Peter, so they get pawned off to an aunt and an uncle.
With an awful child.
And that brings us to the beginning of our book.
Yes.
Now, in the annals of literature, there are opening lines of novels that have become memorable in how significant or how perfectly written they are. "Call Me Ishmael," begins Moby Dick. "In the hole in the ground there lived a hobbit." "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And one of my all-time favorites, "There was a boy named Eustace Clarence Scruggs, and he almost deserved it." I mean, that is a great line. It's almost like Dickens with his names, where you can hear the name Ebenezer Scrooge, and you can just picture Tiny Tim, and you can just picture Eustace Clarence Scruggs, and you just know this kid's a little snot.
Yeah.
So what is Eustace Clarence Scruggs like?
He's a bully.
He's a bully. What kind of bully?
A nasty bully.
I don't know. A verbal bully.
Yeah.
He's a snobby, intellectual, verbal bully who's probably a little wuss. He's probably a little wimp.
Oh, yeah.
But because he's rather smart and because his parents are oh so modern with most modern of thoughts and sensibilities.
I want to know what kind of underwear they wear.
He's a smart aleck, he's a know-it-all, he's a whiner, he's bossy. He's the quintessential single child. I mean, so look at the differences. You got four Pevensey children. Right? You got four Pevensey children. And what happens when you've got four kids?
They share.
Even when they don't like each other, you kind of have to learn to live together. Now, not every single child is a spoiled brat, but what is the temptation of a single child other than I become the center of the universe? And that's Eustace. He is the center of the universe, and he's the smartest, and he's the most important, and only his perspective counts. Now, so the parents, let's describe the parents real quick. We talk about how modern they were. What are some of the ways that Lewis describes them?
Well, for one thing, their names, Harold and Alberta.
And they're the sort of parents who insist that their small child refer to them by their first name. Right. So already I don't like these people.
Right.
And what else?
They're vegetarians.
They are teetotalers, which means no alcohol.
Non-smokers.
Special underwear.
Special underwear.
Let me explain this. Let me explain this for a second. Lewis is trying to paint a picture that someone who is reading this at the time or close to it would recognize.
Oh yeah.
So. What we consider what these folks would be like, if we were to come up with characters that we wanted to be like Harold and Alberta, we would describe them maybe differently today.
Hipsters.
We might say, oh, they wear skinny jeans, and he has a soul patch, and they wear big, thick glasses, even though their eyesight is okay, and they're always talking about obscure music and craft beer, or whatever. So he was trying to identify something that would, by these characteristics, they're teetotalers, non-smokers, vegetarians, and they wear the special underwear that at the time, in the mid late 40s, were super super trendy. Like it was, you're not one of the stuffy old establishment. You're a teetotaler. It wasn't a matter of principle. They were vegetarians because that's what the in crowd did. The special underwear was apparently an in thing It was some kind of this like woven yarny kind of thing that, that was kind of popular in England for a brief period of time. And again, the super in modern crowd were the ones to do this. So what he's trying to do, he's trying to identify them as being the trend followers of whatever era. So they come across as being oh so super principled, but really they're the sort of people who would have responded to, well, I hear that such and such is in. Oh, yes, oh, we knew that. That's what we do, too. I mean, that's the sort of people they are.
To be accepted.
And to be seen as the right sort of person with the right sort of clothes and the right sort of ideas. And that, you know, imagine what that does for the child. Especially an only child who already maybe runs the risk of feeling like he's the center of the universe. He also has parents who basically have no principles, they just chase trends.
Yeah. They don't really care about him.
So he is the sort of kid who reads nonfiction books about boring subjects, not because he's necessarily interested, but because that allows him the chance to name drop in conversations and demonstrate to other people that he's smarter than they are. That's, you know, if, you know, for no good reason, if you start talking about the average rainfall in the Amazon basin, you're just kind of showing that you know this fact, this piece of trivia, because you're smart.
Yeah.
So he's not a kid who seems to be much fun around. He doesn't really seem like a kid. He certainly seems to see himself as just a small adult, with very adult sensibilities and adult maturity. And of course, Alberta and Harold, you know, because we're all peers.
Right.
What's his attitude towards his Pevensey cousins?
He wants to bully them.
Yeah,
he certainly looks down on them.
Very much looks down on them. Edmund, they're both older than he is. Lucy's probably pretty close to his age, maybe a year or two older. But what's his view of Edmund? What do you think? Based off of what we know of Eustace, how do you think he would treat an older boy cousin? What would he assume?
Normally, indifferent.
I would say that he probably assumes that Edmund is dumb, like a dumb jock or something. And I live the life of the mind. You know, because he's no match to Edmund physically.
No.
Therefore, you have to denigrate that. Because remember, you have to think like Eustace. If there's something that you are intrinsically better or stronger than me, I have to find a way to say that that's not important. Mm-hmm. Bring that down so I can be raised up. The things that I know or I'm good at or I'm like, that needs to be understood as being more important. So, you're probably just a big dumb jock. What about Lucy? What does he think about Lucy? She's a girl. Yeah, silly, can't be smart. Yeah, both of them are annoying in their own way. They're both oh so childish.
Talking their Narnia stories.
So. Before we started the first book, do you recall the introduction or the dedication that C.S. Lewis wrote to his goddaughter?
He said that she would probably be not older, before she read it.
Right.
Yes.
That you're probably too old for nursery rhymes or for nursery tales right now, but I hope that one day you will read them again. So there is something about immature maturity. When kids are younger, they love these adventure stories and these nursery rhymes and nursery tales and fairy tales and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, but then they hit an age where they don't want to be seen as a baby. And oh, I'm too big for that. That's kid stuff. That's baby stuff. But then after you get older and you actually do become mature and you don't care so much about what other people think of you, you can go back and you can enjoy things for what they really are. And some of these fairy tales and some of these stories and they are good and they are lasting at every age, but it's only the immaturity of a certain kind of age range that turns its nose up at it because it doesn't want to be seen as being so young. That's where Eustace is. All the good things, all the lasting things, he doesn't want to have anything to do with because he needs everybody to know that he's not a baby. I'm not some little kid. I am so mature. All right. So there we are. There we are, and he and the Pevensey kids. What are they doing?
Basically trying to avoid Eustace.
We've been sentenced to 3 months here, or whatever it is, and
we
gotta
make the most of it.
You know, I kind of envision them just like sort of arm in arm around each other, like we can make it. We'll get out of here one day.
Dreaming about Narnia.
Right, and so you know, what can they do? They talk about Narnia, and it's you know, they're one source of comfort.
There's a picture in the moon of the ship.
And Eustace overhears it.
Yeah, maybe.
And what does he do with that? He's already starting to be nasty towards them, and
he wants to get rid of it.
And then, you know, he's way too old and way too mature for such baby stories.
Lucy seems to have the compassionate side to her towards him.
You know, and she, you know, that is...
She was like that with Edmund when he was...
Yeah, yeah, you know, she was always the most understanding. So, there is a picture. There's a painting. And it's a painting of a ship. And what do we know about it?
It's sailing straight towards them.
Straight towards them. It looks what?
Real.
It looks real.
Narnian.
And it looks Narnian.
Narnian.
Yeah.
Looks Narnian. Mm-hmm. And as they start talking and reminiscing, what's Eustace's perspective on this?
You're making it up.
Yeah.
You're making it up, and that picture, I hate it.
Yeah,
it's ugly and it's dumb, and I'm going to get rid of it, and all of a sudden, what happens?
Well, she comes from the waves and being at this emotion.
It looks surreal, and then it is. It really is moving up and down. The waves really are crashing, and just as Eustace goes to grab the frame, a wave comes through and wipes them all out, and suddenly they're through the frame and they are in the water.
And she's glad she took swimming lessons.
Yes.
Eustace is starting to go under.
So.
He's going to tell his mother.
Yes. We got a lot of Eustace in this chat.
Not that when you're drowning, right?
Yeah. There's no mistake that Eustace sort of reminds you of the word useless. He can't swim. He's gonna wind up drowning Lucy unless somebody, you know, Lucy is a better swimmer, but she's trying to help him, and he's probably just gonna yank her down.
Yeah.
So they are rescued by this boat. This boat that they saw in the picture is actually real, and it's there. There's no way back. There's no frame in the sky. They are just in this place. It is a Narnian boat. They are brought on board, and who is there to greet them?
Caspian.
King Caspian is there.
Yeah.
He was actually the one to rescue them. So he is overjoyed to see Edmund and Lucy again, as they are for him. Not so fond of Eustace, who immediately is complaining and whining and threatening.
Yeah. And he knew he could get the picture frame if he leaned over and he leaned over and it wasn't there.
So let's set the stage to where things are in Narnia. There is a difference in the flow of time between Narnia and our world. But here's the thing. It's not consistent. It's not. You can't predict it.
No.
It could be, you know, when the kids were gone for a year, it was like 1,000 years in Narnia.
Yeah.
They've been gone for a year or so again. So how long has it been?
Three years.
It's been 3 years since Caspian was crowned. So he's a little bit older. He's a little bit more mature. But these are all still. It's still roughly the same time period that they were last familiar with.
Yes.
So. Why are they meeting him on a ship in the middle of the ocean?
Because as he got things settled as king, he wanted to go find the seven people that his uncle had banished from the
That's right.
To see if there's damage.
If you recall, when we got to that point from the last book, I kind of mentioned that those seven exiled lords would come up again. Well, you know, each of the books within within the overall genre of fairy tale or adventure, they also kind of coalesce around something. And this one's a little more of a quest story. And the quest would be to find out what happened to these seven noble lords. These were guys who were loyal to whom?
Caspian
the Ninth. Yeah. And if you, what did Myraz do to them? He didn't kill them. He didn't kill other supporters. He didn't banish them.
He sent them away.
He sent them off on a quest.
He sent them off on a quest. Why? I mean, to get rid of them, but what kind of quest was it?
To find something.
Do you recall? All right, so there's something of note to mark these particular lords as being different from your average Telmarine. These were the only guys who were not afraid of the sea.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, if you recall, the Telmarines were deathly afraid of the woods and of the sea. Why were they afraid of the woods?
The trees.
The trees.
Old stories about the trees and the spirits of the trees, and they thought they were ghosts and all that kind of stuff. Why are they afraid of the sea?
Aslan came from the sea.
Because the old story that Aslan came from over the sea, so because they wanted to suppress that, they just told everybody the sea is terrible and fearful and scary and it's bad. Mm-hmm. Now these seven lords, they were not afraid of the sea. So that should already mark them as being a different kind of person. They were also loyal to the king. And they've been sent away on a quest by Myraz, but Myraz didn't really want them on a quest. What was he trying to do?
Just trying to get rid of them.
Yeah.
We all know the sea's bad. They're not afraid of it, so I'll send them out. They'll all die.
Yeah.
And
they'll never come back.
They'll never come back. But no one can fault me.
Yeah.
Right. It's a scheme.
Yeah.
So Caspian, on hearing that story, he was very struck by their faithfulness to his father, by Myraz's treachery, and he was very struck by the sort of people that they apparently were. These guys were different somehow. And so he wants to find out what happened. So what does he do?
Caspian.
What does Caspian do?
He made an oath on his coronation day.
At his coronation, he makes an oath. And this is a big deal.
Yeah.
We're talking, you know, in this kind of time period, this sort of mindset, oaths are promises. And for a king to make an oath at the time of his coronation, what does he even say about the oath? Because who crowns Caspian?
Aslan.
Aslan. He gets Aslan's permission to make this oath. So this is a serious thing. This is, you know, I swear and I promise.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to find these guys. I want to rescue them if they're alive. I want to avenge them if they're dead.
Yeah.
And I just want, I don't want this mystery to be hanging over us. I want to find out what has happened. Why is an ocean quest, though, so odd or unusual at this point in Narnian history?
There were no ships.
Yeah, remember, these for generations, the sea was to be avoided. So they didn't even have, you know, in 3 years' time, Caspian has tried to kind of get back some of the stuff, but they basically had to go hire a crew and hire a boat from another neighboring island country.
Yeah,
and
guys out.
And so these are kind of baby steps. As a matter of fact, he's very, very proud of his boat, but Edmund and Lucy know what?
It's not very
big.
Even in comparison to other Narnian boats, they had boats in Narnia.
Yeah.
Way bigger than this one.
Yeah.
So, you know, back in the day, when we weren't afraid of the ocean, there was a sailing skill and large boats and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is still kind of on the rudimentary level, but he's committed. He's going to do it, by golly. And so where are they now in this quest?
They've been out for 3 days.
A little longer than that. They made a few stops along the way.
They've been by a couple of miles.
300 miles away.
They are about at the end of what's known. So they're these islands, like a chain of islands, that aren't that far from Narnia.
Yeah.
And so they've gone and they visited them. And they've, you know, in one place they got supplies, another place they had a celebration.
Yeah.
But they're getting close to the last one. What is beyond these lone islands?
They don't know.
They don't know.
But it was interesting.
It's the Great Eastern Ocean.
When the question was raised, where are we?
Yes.
Instead of a longitude and a latitude, he recited all the steps during the cruise to bring them to where they were.
That's right.
Yes.
That was unusual.
Well, why would that be?
They don't.
There is no longitude latitude. There is no longitude latitude. You know, how do you navigate in the ocean when you cannot, it's one thing if you're going by land and you keep the island to your left or whatever, but how do you navigate in the ocean when there's no land in sight?
Stars.
Okay. Stars. How do you navigate when you can't see the stars?
There's
so the position of the sun, and again, that's not always evident. What if it's cloudy day? There are a couple of things. There are a couple of inventions that mean the world and change navigation enormously. You know, you could not circumnavigate the globe. You could not take longer voyages without being able to figure out where you were and where you were going. It's one thing if you know, so-and-so island is 2 days that way, 2 days towards the sun. Okay, you can probably do that. But, you know, 47 days, just going a little bit off course, and suddenly you're nowhere near anything else 47 days later.
Yeah.
So, the compass, the astrolabe, which is allowing you to take angles of the stars, the clock. Without a clock, that was one of the most significant developments in navigation, because that way, with consistency in timing things, you could judge and measure distance.
If you could measure your speed.
But you couldn't measure your speed without the clock. What you can do, once you have a consistent way of telling time, for instance, from dawn to dusk, or from midday to dawn, or whatever, then you can start taking distance and calculating speed. There was no way to calculate speed before, other than something is, you know, 2 days journey away or something like that, because we have no way to measure the time other than these big chunks and blocks, you know, from midday to midday or from one dawn to the next. So all of these things come into play, allowing for, you know, traveling by ship much, much further than ever before. You know, we don't have a lot of sense of what sort of tools they have. We get the sense that this is kind of like, you know,
flying by the seat of the pants.
A little bit. You've got some experienced mariners here, but so far we're going very modest distances, a day away, 2 days away, 3 days away. You are kind of setting off where you don't see land, but you're hoping to see it fairly shortly. But they're about to get to, you know, like you see those medieval maps that sort of stop and they say, here be dragons. Like, what's past? So they're getting real close to that. Why are they doing this? Why are they willing to go off into nowhere?
Because they think that's where the seven men are.
If they're not on these islands we've already visited, they've got to be somewhere else.
And they never came back. So
yeah, they've got to be somewhere else. So we're willing to go on. We're willing to go explore. We're willing to take a chance here. And of course, Caspian has made an oath. Now, that's not the only motivation for the crew.
They also think that, don't they think that they're going into Aslan territory?
Who's on board that's a little bit unexpected?
Reed
Pachinko. Reed Pachinko is there. Reed Pachinko was a hero in the second book,
yes.
Talking Mouse.
And Lucy wants to hug him, but she can't.
Never, because he's just, he's too...
He's not cuddly.
No, well, I bet he is.
Yeah.
It would be hugely embarrassing.
Yes.
It would dishonor him.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has a higher hope, too.
So, Reed the Cheap, why is he on this voyage? Not to fight. He's on a different kind of quest. But it seems, they seem to be in partnership, it all sort of works together. What is the quest of Reed the Cheap?
To find Aslan's own country.
To find Aslan's country.
Okay. Yeah.
When he was just a baby, he was rocked to sleep by a dryad, by a wood woman, by a wood spirit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she sang a rhyme.
Yeah.
Let's find a rhyme.
Okay.
This is important.
Fire and the sky and water meet, where the waves grow sweet, doubt not, Reed the Cheap, to find a home to seek, there is the other east,
which is where Aslan is.
All right, so, so where sky and water meet, what does that make you think of? What do we call where sky and water meet?
The horizon.
The horizon. Okay. To say to go to the horizon is a little bit like going to the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
That's about the end.
It kind of keeps moving now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Now, where the waves grow sweet. Do you know what that means?
Where did they meet sand?
This is England English. Where sweet water means fresh water.
Fresh water.
Okay. It just means fresh water.
Okay.
So
okay.
You're going to go so far that the salty ocean will turn fresh.
Yeah.
All right? Mm-hmm. Doubt not, Reed the Cheap, to find all you seek. There is the utter east. Now, Aslan always comes.
From the east,
from over the sea,
yeah.
And into Narnia. Mm-hmm. Like the sun,
mm-hmm.
rising in the east, setting in the west. Aslan's country must be that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, this feeling within Reed the Cheap, in other places, and in theological works, C.S. Lewis will give a German term, Sehnsucht, this longing. This is the longing for joy. This is the inbuilt desire that we have to be in God's presence. Whether we recognize it or not, he has that beautiful passage about... how when we feel joy in this world, it feels like we're so close to touching something and then it's gone. And it feels like being reminded of a tune that we've never heard, or coming back to a country that we've never visited. That there's something about, it's like on the tip of our tongue, but just can't quite. We feel this almost unsettled sense. This, he says, it's built within us to yearn and long for fellowship with God, pure and perfect and lasting. But because we can't achieve it and attain it in this world, we're always slightly unsettled. We're always slightly hoping for more. Whether we recognize this or not, you know, you can be a non-Christian and you still have this sense somewhere deep down inside, if you will let yourself admit it, that things aren't right and maybe it's like they should be, but I don't know how to make them that way, and isn't there more?
Mm-hmm.
That more is longing for God.
Our hearts are restless.
Until they find their rest in thee. So, you know, that would be... you know, Pascal's God-shaped hole within our hearts that will remain empty unless it's filled the only way that it can be. So there's something within Rinpoche who is kind of the epitome of knighthood. He is valiant and he is courtly and he has, he kisses Lucy's hand and he demands his satisfaction when Eustace is a little brat. But there's something within him that longs for the utter East. And the utter East will be a way to describe. When you can't go any further east, almost like the Platonic ideal of eastness, where you can go no further, that means you have landed where east truly is. You have made it to the end of the rainbow. You have made it to the end of the horizon. That's the sort of thing that can only happen in the presence of God. Yeah. So, he's on his own quest, and some way, somehow, these will all work together. So, what's the state of Eustace? We've kind of talked about everybody else.
He's been sick in bed.
Well, he's been sick in bed. So, Lucy said, if I had my potion here, we can maybe.
And she does.
And she does because Gaspin.
Yep, that's right. And so she gives him some, and
he gets well.
He's better.
He's better.
Except.
He's still nasty.
Yeah, he's still nasty. And he certainly would not admit that she's done something to help him.
No.
He's going to say how disgusting it was. And no, I'm still
it's
so terrible.
He wants to get off at the next
court. He's going to get everybody
he's going to make a report.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a report and it's going to go on your permanent record or something.
Yeah.
And of course he gets in trouble because he thinks it's adorable or funny to swing Reaper Cheap around.
Can you imagine?
That's right. He gets whacked with the flat multiple times. So Reaper Cheap, he's not trying to kill Eustace, but he will correct him.
Yes, he does.
He is just a boy after all, but enough is enough.
You did stab him in the hand a couple times.
In order to get a leg out, because he was
stuck
in my tail.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love how he has a journal.
Eustace starts
recording his thoughts.
The journal was just for points he'd made in school, but now he's writing.
So let's look at Eustace's perspective on the voyage. How does he describe how things are going?
Well, he's hoping it's a dream. He hates to be on this ghastly ship if it isn't a dream.
Right.
Comparison to the Queen Mary, it's nothing like.
No proper saloon, no lady,
no
bed,
nothing
in deck chairs.
So, when you read his own perspective and his own thoughts, he is the poor, put upon, but heroic member. Yeah. Everyone else is delusional. Everyone else is stupid. There was a hurricane and the ship was almost going down. And he's describing things that nobody else would agree with. Mm-hmm. But note how even through this, he's the hero.
I like the thing when he said he calls himself a king and I said I was a Republican.
And
he didn't
Republican.
Even know it.
And then the point where he says he would lodge a disposition against the
That's
whole.
Right, by
yeah.
golly.
British consul.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and how he's been put in the worst cabin.
With all these other people. And Lucy has to screw it all by herself.
So, poor, put upon Eustace. But he's so brave to carry on. He will carry on! So that's kind of where we are, and that's kind of what Eustace Clarence Scrub is all about right now. So here's our quest. Everyone else is starting to be filled with the spirit of adventure. Eustace is still Eustace. And we will be approaching kind of the last little bits of what is known about the world.
Yes. Yeah.
and they will begin their journey. Really, the quest in earnest kind of starts now. Yes?
I just didn't understand. I must have missed something. It was when Eustace went to bed. He was careful to lie on his side.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Yeah. Because Reba keeps smacking him on the butt so many times.
Oh, okay.
He was, he's never been spanked. He's never been disciplined before. He's never been at all, let alone the corporal punishment where, you know, so Reba Cheek carries a rapier, and rapiers are very, very slender and very thin. They're flexible, but very strong. And so, they do have sharp edges, but rapiers are mostly stabbing weapons. And there is a flat of the blade. It's not very, very wide, but there is a part that's not sharp and it's flat. And so hitting somebody with a flat, they compare it to what?
Oh, a birch stick or something.
The birch stick, like being swatted in school.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody was ever hit with a switch.
No.
That was one of the threats of my childhood, is getting a switch cut.
Well, I was. My father did that to me.
So, that and a paddle. So he's never been paddled. He's never been switched. He goes to a progressive school, which means no corporal punishment. The other kids go to what they would have considered a normal school, where you might have gotten the birch rod, because that's what they did. And so, for the first time in his life, somebody has told him no.
Yeah.
And for the first time in his life, someone has backed it up and smacked him on the butt.
Yeah.
So Reba Cheap has taken it upon himself to say, enough is enough, young man. And if your parents didn't do it, then I will.
Yeah.
And used the flat of his rapier like a switch and burned his little bottom.
Okay,
so
that's why he's on his side.
So Eustace is sleeping on his side because his backside is rather too sore.
Yeah.
I know, I just read that.
Okay.
I just kind of went to the next page and thought, okay, we're done.
No, I thought because he thought he was going to be seasick again.
I know, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I went.
All right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
We will do, we'll do 3 and 4. For next time, and 1 and 2 have now kind of set the stage. We've met the players, we know what's going on, we know when it is, and now starting in 3 and 4, the quest itself to find the lost lords, to seek the utter east, that will start really kind of happening with chapter 3 onward. And
it was a question Jeopardy last night about who wrote the
Narnia. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll be in Austin next week. So
we're recording and I'll try to get it done.
Yeah.